Welcome to another episode of Respond to Resilience, along with my co-host, Bonnie Rumeli, LCSW, EMTB. I'm David Dashinger. On this episode, we'll be speaking with John Lynch, the Chief of Police and Emergency Management Director for the town of Wilton, Connecticut, and Nick Poprosky, who is Director of Operations at FinTech Management Services. Our topic, proactive leadership, what makes a good leader? We invite you to like and subscribe to our YouTube channel, Respond to Resilience. Our Facebook page is Responder Wellness, Inc. We're also on bbsradio.com and Apple Podcasts. If you want to catch any of our old episodes or previous episodes, our website is respondertv.com. We'll be back to speak with Chief Lynch and Nick right after this. In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers with vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Respond to Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacy Raymond, and Bonnie Rumeli, LCSW, EMTB. And we'd like to welcome our guests, Chief John Lynch and Nick Poprosky, to the show. By way of introduction, let's hear about their bios. Chief Lynch has been a police officer since 1985. He's also a volunteer fireman, EMT, Chief of Police, Emergency Management Director, and Region 1 ESF 13 Representative. Chief Lynch has a master's in public administration and a bachelor's degree in criminal justice and heads a police department with a 97% community approval rating. Nick Poprosky is an award-winning paramedic field provider and educator who's worked in municipal, fire-based, and commercial and volunteer EMS systems. He currently serves as the Director of Operations for FinTech Management Services, a 300-employee EMS staffing company based in Connecticut. He's a staunch advocate for provider mental health and wellness and routinely presents on the topic of PTSD for the Fairfield County Trauma Response Team. Welcome, Chief and Nick.
Thank you.
So I'm going to start off with a question. We'll start off with you, Chief Lynch, because I would imagine we have viewers that are thinking about promoting, some maybe have aspirations to be chief someday. And to be in a position of leadership must require multiple skill sets and good people skills and a desire to make your organization the best that it can be. So in your job, how does that come into play? What are some of the things that you do to do better or well that help you to accomplish your mission with that?
Yeah, so that's not an easy question. I don't consider myself doing things well. I think it's more of a maybe a natural ability, but it also speaks to, the five chiefs and the command staff that I've served under. I've always identified, things I didn't like and things that I did like. Everybody's unique, and especially at the leadership position. So some things work for me, some don't. But I'll tell you, I think I owe my success to the team that we have here. The shared mission and goals, and how you get to that is by communicating. We have very few union issues, complaints. We're open door here. I meet with the officers casually, formally, and at the end of the day, we share the same mission and goal. Now, that's easily said. It's not easily done. But to get the buy-in for that team concept is, they share their ideas and you listen. They need to know that you care, because I care greatly about everyone that works here. And you build that trust. So I think that helps you move forward and that helps you become successful.
Great. And Nick, same question for you. Like, now that you're in this position of leadership, you're someone who studies a lot, learns a lot, is an educator. How do some of your skill sets come into play for you to be an effective leader and help your organization be the best it can be?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned, you know, my background primarily up until this point was EMS education. And I find that, especially when I'm working with the supervisors that report to me, a lot of what I end up doing falls under the purview of education or mentorship. They're both closely related. I think when we think of education, we think of the instructor at the front of the classroom, you know, reading off a rubric, delivering material. I look at it more from the standpoint of, you know, my site managers will encounter a problem, and, you know, maybe it's a problem that I've encountered before. Rather than just solving it for them, you know, I look at it as an opportunity to coach them through it. I like to ask the question, you know, what challenges are you going to face this week? You know, what's your plan for handling them, and what can I do to help? It's kind of a, you know, typical three questions I, you know, lay out when someone comes to me with a problem. So the education background, I think, really helped me, because I think when we get to a leadership position, our previous experience primes us in to act in a certain way. So I guess I'm biased towards looking at every problem we encounter as, oh, this is a teaching opportunity, or this is a learning opportunity, or most likely both. So that's the lens that I tend to work through. And you know, there's pluses and minuses to having that background, and pluses and minuses to using that set of tools. I think it serves us well kind of in the modern culture that is tends to be, or seems to be, rejecting a little bit of the, you know, previous paramilitary background that, you know, the EMS service basically got from the fire service, which adopted it from the military. So, you know, instead of this, I'm just going to stand up here and direct you what to do. Again, I look at it more like a collaborative approach to problem solving. And, you know, I if someone is aspiring to be a leader, become comfortable with teaching. I think one of the things that the fire service does right is requiring fire officers to take fire service instructor first. Because when you're, you know, a new lieutenant and you're directly working with your crew, a lot of your responsibility is teaching your crew and helping them to perfect their skills. So it's such a fundamental skill set, being able to take something, look at a problem, develop a learning objective, and create content or develop a lesson plan that'll help, you know, achieve those objectives. It's if you can get comfortable with that process, you can take that template and apply it to a lot of the problems you're going to encounter in a leadership position.
So speaking as a leader at my EMS agency, I've learned that surrounding yourself with good people is the most important thing. Having good officers underneath you, having wonderful members that you accept into your organization or that you hire. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, John. You had touched on it before briefly, but I was wondering if you could speak to that a little bit more.
Yeah, so you always want to hire the best. Unfortunately, you don't always know who you're hiring. Everybody has a different personality. It's the mission and the goal. Everybody should be focused on the mission and goal, and how you establish that is taking everybody's ideas and also understanding your community needs, but, you know, sharing that with them. And so in many cases, you may work with an officer that may not be fulfilling that mission. So you need to select your field training people representative of, you know, your mission and goals. You also need to make sure that the officers understand that if somebody is doing something wrong, we need to correct that. We can't allow that to continue. Unfortunately, one bad incident or one perceived negative paints the entire department in that light.
Yeah, I just was actually going to kind of build on that and ask a little bit of a question. In general, when you see a department that has a high-profile incident, do you think that most of the public judgment ends up landing on the officer's actions or the EMT or the firefighter's actions, or is there more judgment in how the department handles it?
So, unfortunately, policing has experienced a lot of public societal disdain based upon, you know, those focused incidents. You know, the Wilton Police Department and the departments in this area, we were progressive. You know, we make sure we have the resources and tools, and our policies are, you know, we're accredited. So we had a lot of what was being called for in place already. You know, we send all of our officers, the town is committed to training. So all of our officers are part of the CIT response teams, which even if they're not a specific coordinator, they have the understanding and they're trained in de-escalation and understanding, you know, the issues that normally you wouldn't understand unless you're familiar with them. So I think that goes a long way in gaining that public trust. But to answer your question, I think unfortunately we tend to be painted, you know, with that one brush from that one or two incidents. And I can't tell you how many times, you know, I woke up in the morning, watched, turned on the news, and you know, and I just said to myself, you know, this is just, you know, two steps back. You know, now we have to work harder to, but you know, you need to connect with the community. So when we went through all of that police accountability, and rightfully so, it gave us the opportunity to prove to our community and the public that we're doing the right thing. We're working with you. You know, our doors are always open. We can't fix what we don't know. So feedback, whether it's positive, negative, is another important component.
Having come from the firehouse culture that I have come from, the kitchen table and the locker room are places where a lot of heated discussions and debates happen as far as, you know, how the leadership is, how they're doing, right? Are they doing a good job, what they could be doing better with how they screwed up? And as leaders, how do you stay in touch with your members? I know both of you attend the Friday Fairfield County Trauma Response Team Peer Support Group. Is that helpful? Is that helpful in kind of getting a read on what's going on with the rank and file and with your other peers in emergency services? I'll throw that one to you, Nick, first.
I think one of the biggest challenges that I've had in, you know, kind of moving up to the position that I'm in is, you know, I have a number of site managers or direct supervisors that report to me, and then all of our staff report to those site managers. So I'm two levels detached from quote unquote the rank and file. And, you know, as someone, I worked as a provider for almost 20 years as a paramedic. So, you know, I'm not someone that was necessarily fast tracked to this position, or I did, you know, 3 years as a paramedic and then taught for 15 and didn't do any field work. So, I do feel like I still have a fair amount of instinct just from that experience of doing the job. And I still do the job. I still pull field shifts. Now, am I pulling 60 hours a week in an ambulance as some of my providers are? Absolutely not. I do think that, you know, attending the peer support group does, you know, help me remember, you know, that the particular set of challenges that you face as a field provider. But you know, I think John was starting to talk about this a second ago when your direct supervisors are really, in my case at least, they're the core of my organization. Because of that dynamic, I have to rely on them to both be checking on their staff and reporting up to me as necessary anything that's actionable on my part. So, you know, it's with 300 employees, no matter how you structure your upper management, you're not going to have FaceTime with that many people. Even in a 35 or 40 man department, you can't possibly know you know, how everybody's doing. So you have to rely very heavily on your direct supervisors to kind of keep an eye on everyone and, you know, let you know if there's something else that needs to be done. So that's the main thing. I rely very heavily on my site managers to kind of check the temperature. And an important component of that is like John was talking about, is you know, creating that open door environment. It's not just about saying, hey, I have an open door policy. It's making the time when someone does come to you with an issue to you know, really listen and actively listen and attempt to validate the problems that someone's having and then, you know, try to facilitate a solution. It's, you know, it's one thing to send out a survey, collect the results and not do anything with it. And, you know, that's one of my problems with sending out staff surveys. It's one directional and it's rare that you see management responding to what's in there. And, you know, it's just like the reviews people leave on Google. You know, the most dissatisfied people are going to leave the most, inflammatory reviews. 80% of your staff might not respond. And then, you know, the handful of rock stars that really love what they're doing may respond favorably. So it is difficult to collect feedback and to keep your finger on the pulse of the organization for sure. But I rely very heavily on our site managers and, you know, tell me, hey, how's everybody doing? What's going on? What do you need?
Chief, from your perspective, how do you stay in touch with the, you know, maintain clear communication channels with your members? And part B is, does attending the peer support meeting help you become a better leader?
So, yes, to the peer support, but I'll explain that. So, you know, as a patrolman going through the ranks and even as a lieutenant, you know, venting is normal. You know, you need to vent. I did my fair share of it. Did I mean everything? No, it's frustration. It's venting. And to Nick's point is that you definitely need to have that open communication, especially like you mentioned your staff people, you know, boots on the ground kind of. The sergeants fill that role for us. So if something's going on or somebody's not doing well, whether it's financially, emotionally, or, you know, family related, you know, if that's not coming up to my level, then I'm not doing a good job getting there. So I will say, you know, we do meet with the union, you know, which is an employee group representative of the members, and we hadn't met. I don't know if it was because of COVID, and we hadn't met in a year. So I was concerned that, you know, we need to meet. So we met and we really had nothing to discuss. And we were kind of kidding around. It just says that we have this open communication. So we resolve these issues, one, before they become an issue. And two, we're always seeking their input. So they feel part of that whole process. You know, it's a sense of ownership that we're all very proud of. And then as far as the Friday or peer group meetings, I'm always one to try to listen to other perspectives. I'm very open-minded and it really has helped me because, you know, I have some family issues over the years. Most have been resolved, thankfully, because of peer support. But I do get an understanding of what others are experiencing and their frustration. And I can't solve it, but maybe I can offer some hope and maybe some clarity on certain things. So for me, it's incredibly helpful. I hope it's helpful for them.
Fairfield County Trauma Response Team is a nonprofit alliance of mental health professionals dedicated to helping first responders heal from trauma, tragedy, and stress. We help as they manage community crises and the everyday demands of ensuring public health and safety. Established in 2011, FCTRT was formed in response to a call for emotional help from the Stamford Fire Department after a traumatic fatal fire. Less than a year later, the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting occurred, and members again served the first responder community. Most recently, COVID-19 created a need for our support. We provide free educational presentations, pro bono sessions to deal with community disasters, and an extensive referral service to trauma-informed psychotherapists. If you're a responder in Fairfield County and need help dealing with duty-related stress, please reach out to us so you can continue to do the job you love. visit our website at fcTRT.org or find us on Instagram at Fairfield County TRT.
I know as a leader in my organization, I try to focus on finding compassion for the members. And when they come with a problem, whether it's personal, professional, finding that understanding as to how they really feel and truly listening. I think being a good listener is so important in our roles, because if someone gets the idea that you don't care, they're never going to talk to you again. And so I think those interactions that we have, even the small ones, you know, when you're rushing to a meeting and someone says, hey, can I talk to you for a minute? Take the minute, because usually I've learned in those minutes, it's really important for those people. They need you. They're coming to you with full trust. And I had an incident where someone wanted to talk to me and I really surely didn't have the time. So I said, look, I don't have the time right now, but I will call you first thing tomorrow and you will have my undivided attention then. And they said, okay. And I called the next morning and it was a half an hour. And it was really important for that person to be heard. And so I think that as much as we have things to say or observations or the way that we might see things could go, I think that to listen to what everyone is saying is so important in our, in these roles. Do you have any thoughts on that, Nick or John? Have you found the same thing?
Yeah, I think, you know, that gets you very far is listening. And, you know, the more sincere your interest is in your employees, the easier that's going to be, you know, to, I think John said in the beginning, some aspects of leadership are kind of natural. If you're a naturally compassionate person and, you know, that, then that part of it comes easy. The challenge that I've been working on lately is, okay, so I've put myself out there. I've talked about my own struggles with PTSD. I've talked about my own struggles with insomnia. And I'm hoping that talking about those experiences lets people know that I am open to talking about stuff like that. I feel like by sharing that, that might help me to be more approachable. Now, the other half of what I'm doing is, okay, so we create this approachable culture, this open culture where we can talk about our struggles and people start trusting us to talk about it. Then what? You know, and for me, I feel like I have only recently started to get a handle on both the, you know, the severity of my own symptoms at some point and personally what I've had to do to address that. So I'm about 2.5 years out from being diagnosed with PTSD, and I definitely am turning the corner with being able to talk about it and explain what worked for me. But, you know, now that I'm putting myself out there, I have people approaching me saying, hey, I heard this and, you know, this is what I'm experiencing. So I've spent the last couple months really looking for resources. So when someone does approach me, you know, what's the best direction to point them in? I think it's you have a critical opportunity when someone finally speaks up. You have an opportunity to really steer them. It's a big step for someone to come up, especially once you're in a chief level position, you know, but even on a peer level, someone's like, hey, I don't feel safe at work. I don't feel like I should be driving because I'm too exhausted. You know, someone comes up to you, that's a big thing, a big step to admit that. But then it's like, what do you do? You know, so a lot of it is becoming aware of what programs are available. You know, I think an immediate step that administrators need to consider is when someone comes to you with that level of issue, an immediate step is like, let's get you out of the fire, right? Like as first responders, when we respond to a hazmat incident, the first thing we do is get everybody out of the hazmat, right? So someone's in a work environment where something's become toxic for them. Whether they come out and tell you they're not safe to work or you just observe it, right? They're not doing their charts. They had a couple of vehicle related incidents or showing up late to work, whatever the indicators are that you should be attuned to or that your direct reports are attuned to, you know, something saying they're not safe to be there. And one of the immediate steps is like, get them out of that environment. And that is something that you can do as a leader. And it does, it's counterintuitive sometimes to your department's mission. The mission is staff people, right? The ambulance calls are still going to be there. And it's not a decision that you can take lightly when you're short staffed, to take someone who works 40 or 60 hours a week and go, I think you need a break. Now that means someone else is going to have to do their work. So, I mean, we have a whole set of organizational, you know, considerations when we're going to make that decision. But I think that's an important gesture. If you say, hey, like, first and foremost, why don't you take a week off? Whatever we need to do to make that happen. Connecticut has the Paid Leave Act. Your department, if it's union, has different avenues. But we have to be aware of how to make all of that happen, because the last thing that someone needs when they're that desperate is for them to say, oh, here's a 3-page document from the state of Connecticut that you have to fill out if you want to get paid 70% of what you were making so you could take some time off. No, I'm going to handle all of that, right? Like, I'm going to do that for you. And, you know, that's just an example of where one of the challenges I've been coming up with. Now I have people approaching me, and I think that's great. And I have some instinct now, just, I can speak from my own experiences, but now I'm learning the next tier of what resources are available and what are some best practices at my level then to address it. Because it's like the floodgates are opening. Now that it's okay to talk about PTSD, I have people that, you know, are like, I've probably been dealing with this for 10 years. You know, I've been a paramedic for 25 or 30 years. So I think we've got a lot of catching up to do. It's going to be overwhelming for a while.
Do you have any thoughts on that, John?
Yeah, it's such a complicated issue. Again, you know, everybody reacts differently to the stress. You know, you may have employees that rely on the overtime, the full payment, you know, and even if you remove them from it, then they feel even more isolated. You know, so a big focus, and Nick has great points. You know, you have to be able to have those resources in place. You know, a lot of departments, especially yours, I think, Nick, you know, you operate as a business. You need to make money in order to pay the bills. So you need to cut. And we've been cutting for quite some time. So you have to advocate for that funding and those programs. And I think the legislators are working, you know, they're understanding it a little more. And they're starting to, you know, provide grant money and services to those people that are in need. But again, you know, the communication, so that's fantastic that they're comfortable bringing forward. But what's next? You know, that question is, what's next? You know, we all have EAP programs, which are fantastic. It's an acronym, most. It's very important. I think we're making the right steps now in the state of Connecticut for policing. I know fire and EMS are doing the same. You know, having these peer support groups built in. You know, I think a lot of employees in the emergency services don't necessarily want to speak with somebody from their own service. They're more comfortable going outside. You know, I propose, you know, each department's establish their peer groups, which they have, but having a statewide network or a regional network. And I've always found that to be, but you know, you do have to put your money where your mouth is, in plain speak, and provide those resources. So as leaders, you know, we advocate for that, because you're only as good as your employees again. And if they're not, you know, if they're failing, you're just waiting for something to happen.
I think we're very fortunate in this area to have our team, the Fairfield County Trauma Response Team, because we're 24 therapists all over Fairfield County, and it's a great referral source for departments. And I would say a lot of the departments are aware of us, use us, and that's a wonderful resource for a leader to say, I'm concerned about this employee, this volunteer, and where we can refer them out and actually connect them to help. So if someone doesn't want to go through the EAP because they're concerned for whatever reason, there are other avenues. There are private therapists who see first responders. So I think that's great as leaders to have all of those options available. And again, confidentiality is very important. So even if you do send someone for therapy, that's between you and that person. And they have to know that that's not going to be used against them in any way, because they have come to you in such confidence and vulnerability. And I think we owe it to them to be confidential and to do our best to get them help and to not be punitive about it. I know there are certain scenarios where we may have to be punitive or deliver consequences because we're leaders, which isn't the fun part at all. But I think that if we approach it more as how can I help you and make this better, people really do better with that. And we're more likely to get them back, and then they won't be saying, well, this institution abandoned me or they ignored me when I was struggling.
And you brought up a great point there. You know, volunteer services don't necessarily have those resources, not all. Right. You know, you're coming in volunteering once a week or twice a week for a shift. So, you know, are you covered under workers' comp or not? Or, you know, I mean, just all of those kind of aspects. And then the confidentiality is very difficult. Keeping the information confidential is easy, fairly easy. It's just when the employee is gone for 2 or 3 weeks, you know, people start talking. So I think that's why it's important for everybody to understand the dynamics of peer support.
Mm-hmm. Well, Chief, on that note, especially as we've sort of touched on institutional abandonment, we frequently hear that term, institutional abandonment and betrayal trauma. You know, I've heard some police officers openly contemplating early retirement, and I've also heard some officers saying that Chief Lynch is a leader they'd like to work for, which is a huge compliment, and it speaks to your very positive reputation in law enforcement. So having said that, you know, what role do teams play in your ranks or your department so you can be a more effective law enforcement leader?
Teams are everything. You know, I'm an inclusive leader, I guess you would say. I'm very honored at the fact that, you know, I get that positive feedback. Again, I solicit both positive and negative. I prefer the positive, obviously. But the fact that I'm receiving that feedback, I'm inclusive. My staff is involved. Decision making, and Bonnie, you touched upon like disciplinary measures. You know, that's something that, you know, I was questioned on when I was up for chief. And I said, I don't like doing it, but I understand. So whenever you discipline, it's all about the goal, the mission, and the least amount. And, you know, over the years, we have some very successful officers, including myself, who had been disciplined early on, and it worked. If it's in a negative sense, then, you know, you've shut everybody off. I don't know that I've answered that entire question, but, you know, my style is inclusive, and I find that works best for us here.
Great. Thank you. And Nick, in your organization, with your hierarchy and your administration, how do teams play a role, and how do you kind of make sure that your members are feeling like you're there for them, that you're advocating for them?
So one of my thoughts that has come up when I'm talking about, you know, peer support is the idea of formal versus informal peer support. And after attending even the first couple sessions of the Fairfield peer support group, my reaction was, you know, what happens in a formal peer support group ends up, you know, mirroring the informal interactions that we have with the best at our departments. You know, we all have that, like, that senior man or that person who's the unofficial chaplain, or, you know, someone who's just a trusted person to talk to and knows to say the right thing. And I think what peer support groups and peer support teams seek to do is take that organic and informal best practice and multiply it. Like, let's formalize it. Let's recognize that, you know, peer support is a really important tool. In my own personal experience, if I look at all of the things that I did to kind of turn the corner with PTSD, peer support was really one of the cornerstones. And I don't think the other more clinical interventions would have helped me if it wasn't for the sense of community that I received out of peer support. So what we're looking into now is kind of surveying our organization, looking who our key stakeholders are, look at who has formal training in peer support. You know, I just sent a group of four of our employees, myself included. Two of them are site supervisors, and one, it was just rank and file. We took a class called Assist, which is a suicide intervention training class. And, you know, I look at that as an example of already the group of people that I assembled to take that class are trusted members of our staff who are, I feel like, are approachable and who speak the lingo. You know, they are open about talking about mental health. They have a positive view of, you know, clinical services to help with mental health. But by taking what they have a natural aptitude for and putting them through a formal training in that, it allows them to cement those skills that they have kind of cultivated, I don't want to say accidentally, but organically. So there's a lot of value in putting your staff through more formal training, developing a more formal program. The other thing that I feel like a peer support team, what I'm looking to get out of a peer support team when we implement one here at my company, is to standardize the language or the lingo. And I think we haven't had the vocabulary to talk about PTSD prior to the last couple years. You know, we would just talk about, like, hey, what's wrong with Bud? You know, Bud's got some issues, or, you know, stay away from Bud. It's a Saturday. He was out on Friday. You know, like we didn't have language, you know, and by taking these classes and being involved with these different programs, when I say to someone, hey, you know, someone's having, I think we have a turning point for this person. And that's terminology out of the Assist program. And when I assemble a group of people and we're trying to help someone and perform an intervention, having that common language to be able to, it helps us to coordinate more effectively. And rather than, you know, peer support being this accidental thing that happens occasionally, by creating a team, sending people for training, and it sends the top-down message that this is important. You know, we're not just going to wait around for this to happen accidentally. No, this is something that, you know, we are supportive of and we're trying to facilitate. So I think that's the real genius of a peer support team, is you take what happens sometimes it accidentally and just formalize it and say, no, this is an important part of this institution and we're going to support these efforts.
You know, very valid points, Nick. You know, the terminology, the process, you know, it becomes almost a routine where it's more comfortable and people are more likely to use it. And, you know, you're not reflecting on the negative words or terms.
You just said the word routine. And, like, I think that's so important, because, like, think about it. If we responded to a heart attack and, you know, we looked at the monitor and we're like, oh, my God, we're all like, what do we do? And we're just and we're all like looking at each other, whispering, and we're like disorganized. What is the patient going to perceive at that point, as, you know, we're supposed to be the experts. So, right. So, you know, by making, you know, first responders routinely get PTSD. We're not talking about prevention. Like, that's a whole nother story. We could do a whole podcast on that. But what we're talking about is responding to someone who has, you know, these, you know, symptoms. And by having a team that routinely handles this or has some training, it takes the, oh my God, what do we do? This, my coworker just told me they're suicidal. Like, what do I do? Like, I the only thing I'm trained to do is bring them to the hospital, you know, and then, like, that's for someone else to deal with, like turf it, like pass the buck. If you can formalize this training and your process and the terminology, and you are able to cultivate a group of people who now have some experience. This isn't the first coworker that told you they're suicidal. And you have some routine, so you could, your facial expression would be like, I'm really sorry that you're feeling that, but we're going to help you. And to have the confidence to go, when I say I'm going to help you, it's not a platitude. I'm not just trying to, you know, say like something, you know, those words have meaning when you have successfully helped other people and you're speaking from a position of experience. You know, when I have a patient that's like, I'm scared, I don't know what's going on, I say, listen, I got you. And, you know, I said this to a patient yesterday, having a really high heart rate. And I looked at the monitor, I'm like, I've dealt with this 20 times before. I have a medication that's going to fix this. And I have the confidence to say, you're going to be okay. You know, I can't say that to all patients, you know, but in this case, and a patient or a employee that comes to you and says, I'm having thoughts of suicide, we can do something about that. And especially taking this class, I can't say enough good things about it. It was 2 days of flat out talking about suicide. We must have said the word 10,000 times, it feels like, in 2 days. And it takes a lot of the power out of it. Like when you start talking about it, by the end of the, you know, in the beginning, you're like whispering about it. At the end, you're like, are you suicidal? Like you feel comfortable asking that question. And then when they say, when they give you anything other than, no, I'm totally fine. If they give you either a affirmative yes or they're probably thinking that way, we have a game plan. So I really like the fact that you said, you know, that you can, that this stuff should be routine. I think it takes a lot of the whispers out of it. Like, oh my God, this so-and-so is dealing with this kind of thing. It's like, no, we all can potentially have to deal with some level of mental health issue in this field in particular, and that's okay. And we have a group of people who are dedicated to helping you, and they have experience and they have the resources and the confidence. That means so much. If someone comes into our peer support group and is like, man, I'm really struggling, and you have a retired captain from FDNY and you got, you know, but people with credentials 10,000 times what mine are going, wow, you know, that's terrible what you're dealing with, but we've seen this before, some of us personally, and we can help you. Like, that's really, really powerful when you can get to that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's more prevalent than we've identified.
Our mission at Responder Wellness, Inc. is to subsidize or provide free of charge safety equipment and wellness services to first responders, including police officers, firefighters, EMS personnel, and 911 operators throughout Connecticut. Resources include scholarships to train new EMTs, a responder and veteran-only AA group in Danbury, Connecticut, as well as police vests, a fire and EMS boot program, yoga classes, gym memberships, and t-shirts. The founder of Responder Wellness, Inc. co-leads a peer support group sponsored by Fairfield County Trauma Response Team. Responder Wellness, Inc. is a nonprofit 501c3. Find us on the web at responderwellness.org, on Facebook at Responder Wellness, Inc., or email us responderwellness@gmail.com. Responder Wellness, Inc., putting responders first.
I think that some of the shift in the culture that we're all a part of here, right? We're being the change and having peer support groups and talking openly about therapy and PTSD, PTSI. And I think we're part of that change. And I think we, even in the course of our short careers, compared to the trajectory of how long these professions have been around, have seen a huge change. I mean, it's just so different now. And thankfully, I think that we're getting to a place where this is just common and people talk about it in the room at the table, whereas no one would have talked about it on that, at that table 20, 30 years ago. So I was wondering if you both see that playing out at your places of business. John, do you see the change just at PD over the years with that topic?
Oh, definitely. You know, years ago, if you dealt with something very significant, we're all affected. You know, every call there is an emotional component, and you just store it and you store it and you store it. And then it starts affecting you and your family life. You're bringing it home. But, you know, the first chief I worked for, you know, you had to be the tough guy, and the staff was, you know, you suck it up, and, you know, and then the second chief brought in, or at the end of that chief's tenure, you know, these new current processes that, you know, the CISD. So you have a bad incident, whether it involves a child or something tragic, you know, you bring everybody together. And the most important aspect of that I observed over the years, one, you're getting it out sooner. you're discussing it among your peers, people who are on scene, and it just amazed me how everybody saw it differently. The person you would think was the least affected, and you're thinking they weren't even there, well, they were the most affected. So that brings you together to talk about it, and it tells you you're not alone. So yes, and I think this peer support program and what Nick was speaking to, not necessarily, I hate to use the word routine, but you know, not unusual, a process. I think that's very important.
Let's change gears here a little bit. And a lot of people out there in our emergency services are looking to promote up from the line or be an officer looking to promote up the chain of command. So Chief, what advice do you have for responders who are desiring to become leaders, either promoting from the line or as an officer who's looking to promote to a higher rank?
Sure. First and foremost is, hey, we're going to make mistakes. You know, you may have been suspended for something, you know, and you still have a career. It's not the end of the world. You know, you overcome that. But first, you have to be interested in that position. You have to be interested in it for the right reasons, not just benefits or a salary or that kind of thing. And if it is right for you, you need to study. You need to follow the process. You know, that's exactly what I did. And actually, I don't know if it's a mixed blessing. I skipped over sergeant to went right to lieutenant. It was all a timing thing. But I'm just saying, you know, I studied and I spent an hour every day just studying. So I tell that to them, you know. And then when you sit down to take the process, you're relaxed. You're more comfortable. You're more knowledgeable. But yeah, aspire. So as soon as you, let's say, become the next level, a sergeant, you know, you should be looking towards your future. You know, some are just very comfortable in their role, their existing role. It's not for everybody. You know, you have to deal with people, and it adds a whole different dynamic to your job.
Nick, in your organization, how do you mentor people that are looking to move up or become supervisors in your chain of command?
The first thing I tell people is if you think that there's even a distinct possibility that you might be interested in promoting, it's never too soon to start preparing for that. You know, I've seen people over the years go 20 something years in a career, and I'm not saying you can't then at that point get serious about it. I've seen plenty of examples of that as well, but there was a lot of wasted opportunity if you spend 20 years, you know, filling a field position or a line position and don't take advantage of any of the training programs that are out there or you know, reading or learning. I think it's completely reasonable as a brand new paramedic to start thinking about at some point you'd like to be a supervisor or even more than that. Along those lines, then, the next thing I would tell someone is your communication now is going to be something that you need to start honing and developing and will be a reflection on you when you start that promotional process. Meaning every email that you send, every meeting that you participate in and speak at is an opportunity to demonstrate that you know, have the communication skills to be a leader. I think that's the number one thing that I select for, or I see gets naturally selected for when I look around at, you know, my peers and other people that have been promoted. Being able to read and write well is probably one of the most important foundational skills. Because you can have the right ideas, you can have you know, great clinical ability, but let's face it, as a leader, you need to be able to communicate all of those things. And you know, something as simple as if you're going to respond to an email from your boss, rather than a couple short phrases with no punctuation that may deliver the point, say, "Dear Chief, I just want to make you aware of an incident that happened," and you know, like writing incident reports, for example. So I would tell people to just start realizing that your conduct as a paramedic or as a firefighter or, you know, as a patrol officer, I'm sure, is going to start to reflect what your leadership abilities are. So it's not like you can just be like, well, I'm going to do my 5 years and just flip a switch and be like, okay, well, now I'm going to start trying to be a lieutenant. You know, the time to start is as soon as you have an interest.
Yeah, we've seen that, right? We've seen people that are preparing well in advance and people that are waiting until the test date is posted and then all of a sudden start doing projects around the firehouse or, you know, around the station and doing things noticed, and it's probably too late in the game to be effective. So, Chief, what were you going to say?
No, I was going to say those are excellent points. Start because you can be the best cop or the best paramedic or EMT doesn't necessarily make you a great supervisor. And the way you do that is you start taking on extra tasks. You start a community program or you work with that. Like Nick said, clearly, you show your skills, you show your abilities. And, so when you're considered, you have that behind you. And again, I will say education. I was completely disinterested in going to school. I never saw the need, in my own compartmentalized career to, become higher educated. But I started late. And I obtained the bachelor's and I found it really did help. So it taught me how to write, like Nick pointed out, and be a little more articulate. I'm not the most articulate, but to be a little more articulate. And it also gave me perspective on, the human nature factors.
I have a little bit of a different take on that, which is when I'm looking for leaders in our organization, I really pay close attention to the people that are trying really hard to be leaders and why. And I ask myself, why is that person trying so hard and why do they want the role? And I really try hard to look for those people who aren't trying hard, who are the natural leaders who gain respect from their peers, who with a little bit of support or a little bit of, rising up and teaching them and empowering them, they would be phenomenal leaders. So I know that's a little bit of a different take than what you were saying, but I pay close attention to who and why and try to really find the diamonds in the rough too, because they can be the best.
I agree. And that's another component of, that person may take on more tasks. So I definitely agree with that as well.
Well, Chief Lynch and Nick, this has been a great conversation. I know we've been talking about how important it is to spotlight proactive leadership and to show that there are positive aspects to administrators, leaders, and chiefs and officers. And I want to thank you both for sharing your perspective today on Responder Resilience.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much
for joining.
Thank you.
We'd like to remind everyone to like and subscribe. We're on YouTube, Responder Resilience, Facebook on Responder Wellness Inc. page, bbsradio.com, Apple Podcasts, and our website with all our past episodes is respondertv.com. We'd like to remind everyone, stay safe, be kind to yourself. Take care.
Thank you.